Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Thanks for tuning in to Heritage Radio Network. This is Leah Eden, and I'm your host today with a special studio recording. We're on the line today with Patty Lavera, the Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch. Now, Food and Water Watch is a consumer advocate organization that campaigns for policies that ensure the food and the water that we consume, it's safe, it's accessible, and it's sustainably produced. The nonprofit organization advocates around issues related to fracking, the Farm Bill, water protection, genetically engineered products, and many others. Patty is here today to talk a little bit about Food and Water Watch's current advocacy work around GMOs. Welcome, Patty.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hey, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it. It seems like there's been this flurry of media coverage lately around genetically engineered crops, the GE salmon, Monsanto. I think it would be really easy to think that some of these issues are new when, in fact, biotechnology has sort of been in and around our food system for years. So before we really dive into the conversation, I wanted you to give me a little sense of history. You know, how long has GE food been around, and how long have GMOs been on Food and Water Watch's radar?
Yeah, it's a good place to start. I mean, I think, so just to be clear on, you know, what we're talking about, because this is one of the most common questions we get, is exactly what is a GMO and what is genetic engineering, and haven't we been, you know, changing plant varieties since we've done agriculture? So, you know, what we're talking about and what people are talking about when they talk about genetic engineering or a genetically modified organism is, you know, is inserting genetic material into something that, in a way that couldn't happen naturally, basically. So this is not taking two varieties of corn and breeding them, you know, and intercrossing them slowly with traditional methods to get a sturdier variety of corn. This is taking DNA from an entirely different species that, you know, wouldn't cross species lines naturally and reproduce naturally, and putting that DNA in that crop, or now even we're talking about animals. So we kind of use the terms biotechnology and genetic engineering interchangeably, but it's worth starting there. And so the research has been going on for a long time, and we really started to see these things entering the food supply in the mid-90s. So the different parts of the federal government have different responsibilities, but the agencies that, you know, are supposed to approve these things and consider them started to give approvals, you know, in the mid-90s, and things really took off, you know, about 10 years ago in terms of the really big crops, corn, soybeans, things like that.
Right, and I think that is a really important point, because one of the things that I've heard some people say is that they don't really understand what the big deal is. You know, isn't this just the same thing that scientists, that farmers have been doing forever and ever, with just more advanced technology based on where we are in science now? But it sounds like you feel like there's some difference there.
Right, and you know, and it's not just us. There's lots of folks, you know, who are concerned about the technology itself. We're concerned about what we don't know about the technology is one of the biggest concerns. Our regulations have not caught up to this technology, and we don't really have the right system for figuring out if they're safe, looking at what else changes. So you've inserted DNA and you want something specific to happen. If you read about this, you'll hear people talk about the trait. So they're inserting a trait. So they want this crop to produce its own insecticide in its tissue. So that's one reason that they will genetically engineer something, or they want it to be able to live. They want it to be able to survive treatment with an herbicide like Roundup, and then the weed next to it will die when you spray the field. But the question is, what else happens when you insert genetic material? Have you changed other things that we need to know about? You know, so we ask a lot of questions about the long-term health impacts, about allergies, about things like that. And the agencies in charge of this are not asking the right questions. They're not asking those long-term questions. And the data that goes into them when they make the decision comes from the company that wants to sell it.
Right. And I think these are all really important questions. I really want to talk a little bit about the regulations, about what are the right questions. But let's structure our conversation around something specific. You know, because there's a lot of different GE crops that are out there. We sort of a lot of times talk in these big abstracts. Let's pick an example. I want to dig into the current debate around the FDA's consideration of the Aqua Advantage Atlantic salmon. This is a fish some people know, some people don't know. It's created by a Boston-based company called Aqua Bounty. And from my understanding, it's a genetically engineered salmon that's in the last stages of getting approved for human consumption by the FDA. And this seems to be one of the big issues you're working on. Tell us a little about, you know, specifically in this example, what are Food and Water Watch's concerns around the approval of the GE salmon?
Sure. I'll do the short list. They all have kind of subtopics, but the categories of, you know, what we're worried about. So this would be the first genetically engineered food animal. So this is new territory in terms of our diet. You know, if you're thinking about the supermarket, this is a new section of the store where we're seeing this technology. And just like our previous experiences with genetic engineering, the FDA is not really examining this in a way that thinks about it as food. So they're using an approval process where they evaluate it like a drug, and that process is just weak on a number of fronts, including, you know, we don't get to see the data, and they're just not, it doesn't make them ask the right questions about whether this is safe to eat. So specifically for fish, the questions we think they should be asking are things like, is anything changing here with allergies? A lot of people have, you know, different allergies to different types of seafood. Proteins change, can change how, you know, allergic people may be or not be to something, and, you know, have we changed any proteins when we change the genetic material of this fish? There's a huge environmental component in addition to whether it's safe to eat. There's a lot of questions about what are the environmental impacts of raising salmon that have been engineered in this way. The reason they're adding this genetic material is supposedly to make them grow faster. What if they get out in the environment? What is that going to do to wild populations? And then, you know, one of the big questions FDA isn't asking is, do we need this? Is this worth the risk? And we think there are real risks. They're spending a lot of time and money getting this approved. Do we really need this? Does this solve a problem that we actually have? And then the last issue is a big one. We don't know. You know, we don't have the decision yet, but the hints that we're getting from FDA are that they won't require this to be labeled. And that's just a real basic consumer right-to-know issue. If you have problems with this, how can you avoid it if there's not a label on it?
Right. So Patty, you bring up a lot of really interesting issues. Let's look at that. One of those questions you brought up, the do we need this question? I mean, you know, I know with a number of GE crops, the patent holders have stated that they're solving specific problems through this new technology. They're making, you know, rice that can stay alive under floodwaters or, you know, as you mentioned, disease or insect-resistant crops. What is that problem that the GE salmon is supposedly fixing? What's that conversation?
So I don't believe one side of the conversation, which is saying it does fix the problem, but I can tell you what folks say. So the folks that want to sell this and the supporters of it are saying that this fish will grow faster and that, you know, is a win for consumers in bringing, you know, affordable food to the market. They bring up things about, you know, feeding a growing planet. There's a lot of talk about job creation because it's popular to talk about job creation, and we just don't think any of those claims really hold up. You know, if we want to have a conversation about feeding a growing planet, and you know, obviously fish is a part of that conversation, you don't start with farmed salmon as a solution. Farmed salmon, you know, they're kind of probably the most egregious example of a very resource-intensive way to raise fish. This is not a sustainable system. They eat more protein than they produce. You're catching other wild fish to feed them in fish farms. The salmon farms, without genetic engineering, are already an environmental disaster. So then adding this technology to it doesn't really bring any benefit at all. And, you know, and then actually there's some irony about making an argument about jobs because the company claims that they're going to produce these eggs in a facility in Canada, and that they're going to raise the fish at a facility in Panama. And that doesn't really seem to create any jobs here, as far as we can understand.
Oh, that's interesting. So why, I see that irony. So, but why are they, why are they going to Canada, going to Panama to do these, to have these farmed fish? Why not in the United States? Are they not being allowed to?
So that's the model they've been using, and it seems like kind of their demonstration model. So they're doing it now. It's experimental. It's not approved. They're not supposed to be selling it, but they have these facilities running. And the another, you know, kind of interesting twist to all this is that the company sent in a proposal to the FDA, and that's what the FDA is considering, and it outlines this very specific plan, Canada, Panama. And because it's laid out that way, that cut out a bunch of environmental agencies in the U.S., who would be able to get into the game a little bit more and talk about the environmental impacts, but only if they were environmental impacts in the United States. And by this production model kind of lets the FDA draw a really narrow scope around the problem and say, oh, we don't see any environmental problems, and we don't have to consult, you know, these other, meaningfully consult these other agencies because, you know, it's not an environmental impact that's in their jurisdiction. So there's like some really fascinating nerdy stuff for people like me in Washington. Watch all these regulations work. You know, the company Aqua Bounty fans keep saying that they're gonna be an egg provider and they'll sell eggs to anybody who wants to buy them. And there's a lot of regulatory questions about who's in charge if it happens in another country.
So that's interesting. That's something that I haven't heard before. I had always, it was my understanding or my impression that they were going to be doing the farming as well and sort of selling the fish. So who are they selling these eggs to? What's that next step for them?
So this, you know, it depends what article you read or who you know, when you hear it, but they're mentioning countries like Chile and China where there is a lot of aquaculture production. And it remains to be seen, like, who's going to want these eggs. There's some folks in the commercial salmon, the farmed salmon industry who are saying, we actually don't need this technology because our fish grow pretty fast already. We're doing traditional breeding. So it remains to be seen whether there really is even a market for this technology, for all of this hype about how beneficial it's going to be.
That's interesting. So I want to get into that nerdy conversation a little bit about the regulations, because that's one of the pieces that it feels unclear to me, but is so interesting. You know, and as you've talked about, there's sort of been this line drawn where because it's not happening in our country, the environmental organizations don't have a say necessarily. And you know, according to the today's laws or our current laws, the FDA seems to regulate the GE animal, the GE fish specifically, as an animal drug. And from my understanding, this is sort of an easy way to bring this new technology under current regulation rather than sort of construct a new rule based on what's actually happening. And how do you sort of make sense of these regulation, whether it's loopholes or shortcuts? Sort of what do you feel is missing from the current regulatory system or the current discussion around how these regulations are taking place or not taking place?
Yeah, it's a really important point. And that's part of why it's even bigger than just this decision about this fish. This is the first genetically engineered animal. It won't be the last if it gets approved. There are others, you know, in the queue behind it. And so kind of all eyes are on this one because it's the first one, and it really will be setting a precedent, you know, for how this stuff gets decided. And it just shows how deliberate a lot of the decision-making is and the lobbying and the pressure that comes from the biotech industry and the food industry. The decision about how they were going to decide on genetically engineered food animals was made in, I believe it was 2008. In late 2008, the FDA said, this is the process we'll use. And then they were quiet for 2 years. And before they said, okay, now we're going to start to put this salmon through that process. So, I mean, they laid the groundwork a long time ago, and it's just not an appropriate process. There's a lot of problems, the biggest of which is the transparency. We don't get access to the data that FDA is using. We have access to summaries of it. So that drug approval process is just the wrong one. So we along with some other consumer groups, have petitioned the FDA and said, you're doing it wrong. You should evaluate this like a food additive. That's not perfect either, but at least you have to do more safety stuff about eating it. They said no. You know, what we ultimately need to do with really genetic engineering as a whole is admit that this is different. This is not just a tweak to an existing food. These are different foods, and we need to come up with a new regulatory system that treats them differently and would really have very strict instructions about some long-term studies independent data that doesn't come from the company that wants it approved, and just thinking about it as the food that it is, not just, you know, a slight tweak to an agricultural crop.
Right. And, you know, you bring up this idea, this concept of the data and not having access to the data. And, you know, I think one of the large concerns that I've been talking about, I've been hearing about, has been about what research has been done, what data the FDA has actually been looking at to, you know, approve or not approve this salmon. And it seems like they looked at a study that was created by Aqua Bounty, the company that's going to make their money off of the approval of the fish. And I've also heard there have been some third-party scientists involved who reviewed the research and kind of given the thumbs up. But there seems to be a little bit of public confusion about what kind of data did they look at, what's out there. Can you clear that up a little bit for us from your understanding? What did the FDA have, and what do you wish they had?
Okay. So the company Aqua Bounty put in an application. All right, so that's technically a new animal drug application, and so there's, you know, all kinds of things they have to put in that package for FDA to look at. So some of the studies, what the public can see, the FDA released a summary packet of the application, but it's not the full thing. It's not every page. It's not the raw data. It's a summary discussion. That's what we're working off of, everybody in the public. They also have an advisory committee, so it's a veterinary medical advisory committee, and that meeting happened in the public, so you could watch it. So, you know, folks like us go and watch the committee meet, and now we have a transcript of that committee of experts. And so that's kind of what we're working with, what those experts on the panel said and recommended, and then this summary data. So, you know, what we know is that there are not really that many studies. It's a handful of studies. Some of them were done by Aqua Bounty. Some of them were peer-reviewed, but not all. And many of the studies themselves were quite small. One of them had a sample size of 6 fish. And so that's become a big issue, is that, you know, the statistical rigor that you would want to see mm-hmm. isn't there. And so phrases like being underpowered, like there's not enough power in the data to show you significant conclusions, came up a lot when that group of experts met. And so a lot of them were kind of pro-biotech. There weren't a lot of critics in our minds, you know, on that panel. And even that panel was like, this data is not up to par. That was one of the themes that ran through the couple days. So we've pulled a lot of that out of the transcripts, these quotes of people saying, you need more data, you need to do a better job. And FDA hasn't made the company do that. They're still working with that same pile of limited data.
So, I mean, my natural question is why? You know, why isn't there something in the regulatory system that says there has to be adequate data and it has to come from someone other than the company? You know, is that something that's, I mean, is that unique to food products? Is that just how the regulatory system works?
It's how a lot of the regulatory system works. I think that's a shock for folks, you know, and so when we have things like drugs, you know, human drugs, and you hear a controversy and there's side effects and it's being pulled off the market and people wonder why, mm-hmm. this is how that system works too. You know, the data does come from the folks who want it approved, and that's, we should be questioning that. I mean, there's inherent questions of conflict of interest there. And if you're really getting a full picture, and so that's part of what you would need in an overhaul of this regulatory system. So if you're talking about biotech foods, you know, you would have to spell out what kind of studies you want to see. We would want to look at things like allergies and you know, changes in proteins and things like that. But it's not just the food system, but it's particularly acute. I think it's particularly severe when we're talking about these new technologies, how big the gap is between what we would want to see and what we're actually getting.
That's interesting. And I mean, are there organizations or individuals who are sort of calling for an alternative for that, a different way to get data? One of my questions in there is sort of who else would be paying for that kind of research if not the companies that are investing in it?
Yeah, it's a great question. That it's, you know, and that's why it's been so hard to change, is it is a real resource question. I mean, the FDA is not set up to do these studies, right? They don't have, they don't necessarily have that capability, and it would take money to do that. And right now, the money conversation we're having at the government isn't about giving them more. It's about taking it away, right? So these are all kind of intertwined. You know, one of the things that we've studied when it comes to food, again, just because that's where we spend our time, we did a study last year looking at USDA. So they're the ones who approve the crop. You know, it's safe to grow this genetically engineered corn, and FDA is supposed to say it's safe to eat it. So USDA spends a lot of money on research on agriculture. They used to spend more, and what they're spending it on, and it goes to these universities that are called land-grant universities. Every state has one, and they tend to be like the agriculture school in your state. So it's, you know, it's Texas A&M or Iowa State, or, you know, every school has one, and a lot of agricultural science comes out of these places. It used to be that a lot of that money came from USDA, and now the USDA's share of that funding is going down, and corporations' share of that funding for research is going up. Not surprisingly, those research projects that are getting paid for are ones the corporations are interested in, and it's new genetically engineered crops, you know, commercializing them and developing them. It's not safety studies about whether they're safe to eat. That's not getting paid for.
Hmm. Well, it often always comes down to the money part of it. Well, this is really interesting. I think we're going to take just a real quick break and then come back and talk a little bit more about where the money fits in and the labeling concerns. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're talking to Patty Lavera of Food and Water Watch. We will be right back.
This one's called Paid Dues by RecTech on heritageradionetwork.org.
This is Chris Howell from Cain Vineyard and Winery. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cain encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. For more information, visit cain5.com.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Welcome back. This is your host, Leah Eden. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org. We are back on the line with Patty Lavera, the Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch. Welcome back. So one of the issues that isn't always part of this conversation is who's making money off the GE crops or the, you know, the GE salmon, the food. What role do you think patents and profit have in the discussion about approving GMOs in our food supply?
A huge role. I don't, you know, I think that's one of the things people are most shocked to learn, I think, when they learn about these, is just, you know, the money impact and the way it's changed this industry and really changed the food supply from the financial side of things. So there's a couple, I mean, there's so many things that are interesting, but I think some of the most interesting things are these changes they're making, you know, whether it's a trait they've engineered the crop for, you know, if it's producing an insecticide called BT, or it's making, you know, making the crop tolerant of an herbicide like Roundup. That's the trait, and the companies are so pleased with it and so proud of it, they'll patent that. And so, they're saying it's unique, they're saying it's different. But when we want a label on it, they're like, oh, it's exactly the same, and there's nothing different to see here, and that's why we shouldn't label it. And then there's a huge financial impact that's happened. It's really changed the structure of agriculture. It's changed, you know, the entire way the system of seeds, you know, and the inputs into agriculture happen, and it's really put control of that resource into the hands of just a couple companies.
And how does that work? How does that work in the salmon industry specifically? I mean, you mentioned earlier the impact this might have on wild salmon, whether, you know, these fish can get out, or kind of the impact on the fishery industry. Tell us a little bit about, you know, are there concerns that you're hearing from the wild fishery industry?
Absolutely. So there's, you know, there's already controversy about a salmon is not a salmon. So folks, you know, in Alaska and California and the Pacific Northwest who are out there fishing for wild salmon differentiate their product from farmed salmon with good reason. They're very different fish just because they both are salmon. The way that they live and how they're raised and how they're harvested, all of that makes a difference. And so we already have that distinction, and the wild salmon fishermen are always trying to distinguish themselves in the marketplace because the environmental problems from farmed salmon and just the difference in the quality and taste and all of that, they don't want the two products confused. And so they absolutely have a stake in this, and they don't want GE salmon on the market kind of hurting the brand of salmon, and they're really, really, really concerned about the environmental impacts that, depending on who's raising genetically engineered salmon and where, if they escape and they get into the environment and they are competing with wild populations for food or, you know, doing some other environmental damage or spreading disease or something like that, that that hurts, you know, the wild populations that they're dependent on.
Right. And those are certainly important issues. But you also brought up salmon tasting different from salmon. And that's something that I haven't heard anyone talk about. Does anyone know how the GE salmon taste? Is that, are we at that step yet? Or does that come after, you know, if they are approved? Has anyone tasted them?
So we haven't. As far as I know, the packet that the company turned into FDA had some, you know, small amount of data about, you know, they would call it sensory issues, or, you know, if it's, mm-hmm. you know, if it's an effective product. And they presented a quick summary of that when they had their public meeting, and they were like, everyone we gave it to loves it. It's fantastic. You know, it wasn't really more in depth than that. And then I have seen one television interview where a reporter was served from salmon and didn't really say much about it except it tasted like salmon. But I think if anybody's ever had wild caught salmon and then compared it to farm raised, there's a difference there. It's a difference in what they're eating, you know, and the kind of life that they lead and how much activity they have, and, you know, even the breed of salmon that they're using. So there are distinctions there, and it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what these things actually do taste like when they hit the market.
Right, right. So we're just coming up towards the end of our conversation, but one of the last things that I want to talk a little bit about is the mandatory labeling of GE fish as well as other foods made with, you know, GE crops. And that's one of the things that Food and Water Watch is spending quite a bit of time talking about and campaigning for. Why does your organization feel that labeling is important, not just whether it gets approved or not approved?
So when it comes to salmon, I mean, the fight before us right now is this approval fight. And, you know, lots of groups are working on this, ranging from, you know, Alaskan salmon fishermen to environmental groups to consumer groups. And so, you know, we're all focused on that, and we're in a comment period right now that's, you know, about to end, and we need the public to weigh in and say, don't approve this. But they've sent us some very strong signals, you know, that we can't ignore, and there's a chance this thing gets approved and that it gets to the market. And then it just becomes basic common sense. If you're going to put something this different and this controversial that people have concerns about, you're going to put that in the market, then you have to let people decide for themselves. You know, you have to give them the information so they can do that. So there's a really, you know, really robust conversation happening all over the country about labeling genetically engineered foods across the board. And I think the salmon example just shows people why you need this information. Very few of us are going and catching our own salmon so that we know, you know, that we can know exactly where it came from. And we need labels. They serve a purpose. And when something has this many issues tied to it, we should be able to decide for ourselves if we want to eat it. You need a label to do that.
Right. And, you know, we've talked about a lot of really interesting issues. And I'm wondering if GE foods, if the GE salmon are labeled, if they are, if mandatory labeling does go into effect, is that considered a win?
I think it is. I mean, the biggest win would be that they don't put it on the market, and we're really still focused on that. But in the circumstances, you know, under the circumstances, if they approve it and we can force them to label it, that is an achievement, because historically the FDA has been anti-labeling. They haven't given us this labeling on other things. Their policy that they use is wrong, we think. So it would be an achievement to get them to label this, and you know, we're going to work on that too. Right now we really just don't want them to put it out on the market. And people are having this labeling conversation. I mean, there's bills in like 20 different states, including New York. There's soon going to be federal legislation about this. So people are talking and demanding GE labeling, and we will get it. Eventually, it's a question of where first, you know, at what level. I think it's going to happen because people are just sick of not knowing this when they have all these concerns.
And as the GE salmon gets closer to this, you know, potential approval, of you, as you've talked about, there have been a number of restaurants and companies like, you know, Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, other stores that have promised not to carry the GE salmon if it's approved. And I'm wondering, if the consumer market isn't as large or, financially feasible as expected, what is that impact?
It's a good question. The question, we don't know the answer yet, and time will tell. But I think it will show, I think it shows a couple of things. I think it speaks to this question of need. You know, is there demand for this? Like, setting aside, is this the way you feed a hungry planet? Do consumers want this? Are they interested in this? So it's really interesting to see these stores step up and say, we don't think our customers want this. You know, they're telling us they don't want it, and we're going to listen to them. So I think it speaks to this, a lot of the hype about how great these products are. Hopefully, it educates, some of our policymakers and elected officials that these concerns are real. And this is not a small group of people who are worried about this. It's most people are worried about this. And, maybe that starts to change the debate, and we are able to then move, the politicians and move on the political side, which is what it's going to take to kind of ultimately tackle this problem.
Mm-hmm. And one question, that I've heard thrown about quite a bit is, what can individual people do to sort of voice their opinion on the labeling issues, the approval issues, the regulatory issues? You're an advocacy organization. What do you encourage people to do to advocate for these important issues?
Well, you just mentioned several, and there's always things that people can do. I mean, the easiest thing to do, honestly, is to find a group. We would love it if it's ours. So at foodandwaterwatch.org, you can get updates, you can get on our email list, and we'll tell you when it's time, on this issue and other food issues. So right now, before the end of April, people can comment to the FDA and tell them not to approve this fish. We're also always giving people opportunities to comment to their state legislature. So there's for folks in New York, you can be writing to your state legislator saying, I want you to support this legislation that would require labeling. At that level, you'll be able to do that. On the federal level, very soon, there's a bill coming. So there's always opportunities. And when you meet with your elected officials, whether it's your local government or, a senator is home doing a town hall, they need to hear about these issues. They hear about the budget. They hear about Social Security. They hear about all this stuff. They don't actually hear that much about food, and we have to change that. And they have to hear very specifically from their constituents. They expect them to work on this.
Mm-hmm. Well, Patty, I really appreciate you, spending some time with us. I think you've brought up a lot of issues that are tied very closely together, and I think it's really worth spending some time trying to kind of tease them apart a little and understand the bigger picture. So thank you so very much. This is Leah Eden. I've been your host today. This has been another special recording on Heritage Radio Network. If you miss even a moment of today's conversation, it's available live on our website, like all of our 30 live weekly shows at heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download our shows at iTunes or Stitchers. If you like what you hear, want to support us, click that donate tab and become a member today. Thank you so much for listening, and keep coming back.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.